Welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman. On this week's bumper episode, we'll be discussing the cult of Corbyn, Sharia courts, gossip columns, and orchid hunting. First, in this week's magazine, Rod Little examines the phenomenon that is Jeremy Corbyn and describes how the young people of the nation have been gripped by a collective delusion. To discuss this subject, I'm joined by Hugo Rifkind, who was at Glastonbury last weekend, and Ellie May O'Hagan, a Corbyn-supporting journalist. So, Hugo, you seem to suggest in your piece that Corbynism is a sort of cultural fad, a bit like dressing up, and that it might fade away quite quickly.
Yes, sort of. I mean, I think it's more about identity than policy, or at least the aspect of it I saw last week was more about identity than about policy. I think what Corbyn is doing very well is raising the issues that a growing demographic cares about. It sounds a bit odd to say the young and the formerly young, because everybody's formerly young, but I think we concentrate an awful lot on the sort of the under 25s, and actually I think the real Corbyn demographic is the kind of under 40s who are worried about primarily things like housing. Ed West wrote about this very well on Coffee House this week, but also about just the general sort of quality of life not being what they'd been led to expect it ought to be. And I think Corbyn talks to that demographic very well, although whether he has solutions for them is sort of another question.
And so you were at Glastonbury last week and you saw Corbyn in action. How did he compare to the bands that you saw?
Well, I didn't literally see him in action because I couldn't get close because so many people wanted to see him. I mean, he had a bigger crowd than Radiohead, a bigger crowd than Ed Sheeran. But I mean, it's quite hard to know what that means because, you know, everybody wanted to go and see him. I wanted to go and see him, and I probably wouldn't vote for him. It wasn't a good speech. It didn't really matter that it wasn't a good speech, but I mean, it just wasn't. You know, he stood there saying, he said there's only one planet. Not even Donald Trump thinks there's more than one planet, and I think pretty much everyone thinks there's more than one planet. So that was a little confusing. He hadn't done much work on the speech, and I know that might sound like a sort of trite and slightly crap Westminster-y thing to say, but I mean, it could have been massive. It could have been the point at which historians look back at and go, this is what Corbynism was. And if they do, they're going to be just a bit bemused because he was just rambling on a bit, I thought. And yet the crowd loved him because of what he represents.
And is it not the case that actually the crowd at Glastonbury doesn't really represent the general population? It's quite a niche group of people who probably weren't going to be anything other than very sympathetic to Jeremy Corbyn.
No, I think people underestimate what a broad spread of society is there. I mean, Hugo was there, so, you know, that does say something.
Working class hero.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
But regardless, you know, 12.8 million people voted for Labour as led by Jeremy Corbyn. And so I don't really think it matters whether Glastonbury was representative of the UK as a whole or not, because the fact is that 40% of the UK voted for him. And I also think a crowd of 200,000 people who really wanted to see him, he was invited there, of course he should take advantage of that. It would be insanity for any politician who was invited to talk in front of an audience of 200,000 people on a performance that was being broadcast on the BBC to turn it down. I don't know why you would turn that down. So I don't really understand why there's so much controversy around him speaking at Glastonbury. I just think it was a sensible thing to do on his part.
Do you think supporting Corbyn has become a sort of cultural expression for some people, a bit like having a veg box or a folding bike or something like that? So it says something about your values as a person.
No, absolutely not. I think what has happened is over the last 30 years, there's been a profound change in the economics of this country, which means now that, as Hugo was saying, people under the age of 40 aren't guaranteed to be able to own property. They're not guaranteed job security. They know that real wages will be flatlining for some time to come. They're worried about the future. They're worried about the climate, all of these kind of things. And Labour under Corbyn is the first government in my lifetime, I'm 32, to offer something that really seems radical enough to be able to address these massive problems. And I think the identity politics that have grown up around Corbyn, you know, so there's this certain vernacular that people use to talk about him, you know, there's a nickname for him, the absolute boy is what they call him. And there's a sense of like...
Who calls him that? Because we don't call him that in the Spectator
office. Like is that his... No, his supporters,
oh, I
yeah.
see. Okay.
His nickname is like the absolute boy. It's like, what a lad, you know. And the thing is, it's like, it is ironic because he's so unladdish because he like makes jam and rides a bike, etc. But it is also an expression of like, he's one of ours. And I don't think it's because people want to display how cool they are by supporting Corbyn, or they want to display how liberal and socially minded their politics are, I think it's straightforwardly a reaction to the incredible negativity towards him in the press. He's faced negativity like no other Labour leader, like no other politician I can remember. And I can say this firsthand as a journalist who spoke out in favour of Labour since his leadership and supported his leadership, that you were made to feel, if you were associated with Corbyn, like you were a crank, and you were made to feel as though it was a source of shame to support Corbyn. In fact, I remember doing a podcast in this very office with James Forsyth when he was first elected as leader, or I think it might have been just before, but when it seemed like it was a done deal that he would definitely be leader. And I was laughed at for saying that I thought he had a shot at the time. Just a couple of days before the general election, the journalist Dawn Foster said on Sky News that she thought it would be a hung parliament, and she was laughed at by the host, Kay Burley, who then later issued an apology. So this is how people who supported Corbyn were kind of portrayed in the mainstream as cranks, as cult members, as people who were losing their grasp on reality, whose people were just interested in making a kind of display of who they were rather than winning elections. And so therefore, this culture that is now surrounds Corbyn, the fact that people wear it as an identity, it's an act of defiance.
And it's become a positive thing, and exactly, you have been vindicated. And Hugo, this is a problem for the Conservatives. For Theresa May, obviously, has many problems, but for the Conservatives more widely, in that May painted herself as the Maidenhead woman, the ordinary woman in touch with normal people. Turned out normal people didn't actually like her very much when it came to the election. So how can the Conservatives tap into popular culture in a way that doesn't make them look like William Hague wearing a baseball cap?
Well, I mean, they've never managed to do it, so I don't really know. The only person who sort of came close was David Cameron, and he more or less gave up on the idea. But look, the interesting thing about the Corbyn vote and the Corbyn support is, like a lot of things that keep happening in our politics, it's massive, it's all-consuming, and we don't really know what it means. I knew vast amounts of people who, before the election, were talking about how they were going to vote Labour but not for Corbyn because they supported Labour but not Corbyn. That was a real demographic. Those people have sort of disappeared. You don't really hear from them anymore. You don't really. And what this is what happens when you get a vote in an election is you get to bank all that vote, even when it comes from some people who thought they were voting against you. So, I mean, I think the point where Corbyn and Corbynism may go wrong is where he takes the vote that he got and the support that he had as a gesture of support for the politics he has always had, rather than for the specific platform he was running on in this election. I think he's surrounded by a lot of people who are going to be very keen for him to do that. People keep talking about how the pending schism between the Corbynites and the McDonnellites, and some Labour people get very upset when you talk about it. They think you're trying to divide and conquer or something. But it is there, because McDonnell does have that old hard left thing that thinks the old hard left has the answers. And Corbyn is doing something, I can't tell if it's more interesting or more vague, but it is much more of a cultural identity thing. It is much more of a kind of, I don't know, sort of warm, happy, sunlit uplands kind of feeling. And at the moment, it feels a bit insubstantial. And when they have to put substance onto it, I don't know if it's going to dissipate or kind of last. How the Tories match that, I mean, I have no idea. I think the Tories are cooked for a few years. There's not really much they can do at all, I don't think.
I'd be interested. Can I ask you, Hugo, how many... I've noticed in your column that you write, "I understand what his adoring fans believe he represents, but I'm buggered if I can figure out why." And I'm just curious, because there's no mention in this column of you speaking to any of them. So I'm wondering, you were surrounded by hundreds of thousands of Corbyn supporters there, I presume, or at least thousands. And there are momentum meetings going on up and down the country all the time. I'm sure I could put you in touch with some people who run them if you'd like to meet them. There's also CLP meetings happening all the time. I'm just wondering whether any of these observations that you're making have come from talking to this demographic of people, because it doesn't really sound like it. And I have spoken to hundreds of these supporters and listened to what they have to say. And I just find this very curious, because I definitely think that when it looked like UKIP was on the up, you know, and there was definitely a sense in mainstream journalism that we don't understand this phenomenon, there was a lot of interest in their supporters. And I just don't see the same curiosity from you, especially even now. And I'm wondering why that is.
Are you going to tell us that your best friend is actually a Corbynista?
Well, like I said, one of the four people I was actually at Glastonbury with is a fervent Corbynite. But I mean, I think if you think I'm, I don't, if you think I'm more critical of Corbynites than I was about UKIP, I'm not sure you've been following my writing very closely, which is fair enough. I don't really know how to answer that. I speak to lots of people who support Corbyn. I mean, I met up at Glastonbury with one of my best friends is Jeremy Hardy. I met up with him for a bit and we discussed policy. You know, so I'm not in some kind of bubble where everyone I know is a Tory. Almost no one I know is a Tory. Almost everybody I know voted Labour. Some of them voted for Corbyn, some of them didn't. I speak to people like anybody speaks to people. I spent weeks before the election travelling the country speaking to voters, you know. So, I mean, it would be helpful, I suppose, for other positions of an argument if I was sealed in a bubble, but I'm afraid I'm not.
Okay, and finally, this is the question that makes all journalists break out in a cold sweat now, but I'm going to ask you two to predict whether you think that Corbynism is going to spread or whether you think it has peaked. Ellie first.
Well, I think obviously it depends on how the next few years play out. I mean, one thing that we can be certain of is that politics is very volatile at the moment and nothing can be predicted with any certainty. But absolutely, I think it has the potential to spread because the underlying economic issues that have made it so popular are not going to go away. There's no sign that this government is going to try and rectify them in any significant way. So absolutely, and to coin a phrase from his supporters, boy gone do it.
Hugo?
I think it depends on what he does. I think it depends on whether he tries to turn himself and the Labour Party into Britain's answer to the kind of Macron phenomenon. I know there are other people who want to do that instead, and I think if Corbyn can take Labour in order to do that, I think it could spread. I think, I think if there was another election soon, he would do very well. I think the danger for him is if he and the people around him do see the massive support he's got at the moment as a sort of validation of the sort of stuff they've been saying for 30 years, when it isn't quite that. Has it peaked? No, I don't think it's peaked. I think there will come a point where quite a lot more of the Labour Party gets behind him. And the big question is whether or not he says things to put them off and send them away again.
That was Hugo Rifkind and Ellie Mae O'Hagan.
Hello, I'm Sam Leith, literary editor of The Spectator, and I present the weekly books podcast, at which you'll hear lively discussions from the best and most interesting critics and writers and authors out there, from Charlotte Rampling to Daniel Dennett, all the way past to Michael Morpurgo. I very much hope you'll give us a try. Just search for Spectator Books on the iTunes store.
Next, across the country, Sharia courts are continuing to operate outside of British law. James Ferguson spent a year visiting Muslim communities in Britain and writes in the magazine about finding himself more sympathetic to these councils than he had anticipated. He joins me now, along with Pragna Patel from Southall Black Sisters. So James, you describe your visit to a Sharia court in Oldham and how it was actually relieving women from abusive marriages. And the description in your piece, I have to say, was quite astonishing for me to read. Do you think that this is the normal function of a Sharia court, or do you think you were being given a sort of special treatment on your visit?
Well, first of all, it was quite astonishing to me as well, because I had the same preconceptions about Sharia as everybody else does. And second, definitely, it was not a fixed-up thing. I mean, it was quite difficult to persuade any Sharia council to let a non-Muslim, nosy white journalist like me in to have a look. And I found that one through contacts in Dewsbury. It was just happenstance that I went there. So I'm absolutely confident that it was not a set-up job. And it was very surprising. I mean, I had the same preconceptions about Sharia, you know, the bad bits that you hear about, you know, stonings to death and all of that. And it wasn't, the hudud punishment didn't come into it at all. All that they did was issue divorces to mostly very badly abused Muslim women across the north.
And why couldn't those women seek help from the British law system?
Because they were in nikah marriage only, and the English civil system does not recognise nikah marriages. So if those women wanted to get divorced, they couldn't apply to the courts. They're simply not recognised. The only way that they could get out of those marriages, nikah only, was to go to a Sharia scholar to issue the divorce.
Pragna, does this square with your views on Sharia courts?
No, not at all. I mean, I think that the whole scrutiny that's been brought to bear on Sharia councils and Sharia courts, as they like to call themselves, has been a long time coming. Our experience, and we've worked with really abused, marginalised black and minority women of all backgrounds, and Muslim women actually make up the majority now, is that listening to those women and listening to their testimonies of how they interact with religious authority at times of distress is one of a complete, you know, negativity. Their experiences are that they are not listened to. so-called justice is often delayed or not granted. They're not believed.
Yeah.
These are not forums that are set up to deal with abuse and violence. I mean, you know, black and minority women have been campaigning for over 30 years. I myself have been campaigning for 38 years for minority women in particular to break the kind of taboos that exist in our communities that prevent women from exiting from violence and abuse and so on. Religion is hugely implicated in the abuse and violence that they experience because the discrimination and violence that they experience is justified in the name of culture and religion. And the two are intertwined. In the lived reality, you cannot disentangle culture from religion. And we've seen that actually these forums violate women's human rights in fundamental ways and deny them exit or deny them their rights. And it's in the family arena that most of the violations are concerned. So it's not a question of whether they're implementing the more extreme kinds of a Sharia that most people associate Sharia with, the criminal punishments, the stoning to death or the death penalties or the hanging and flogging.
Which they're not.
It's not that. Well, they're not going to do that because there's no public appetite for that in the UK.
Well,
but what there
the
is
law.
Public appetite for is cultural relativism, the idea that women, minority women, should be subject to their own religious processes rather than the law of the land. So we find this profoundly discriminatory, the idea that if you are minority women, you should be subject to your religious laws, whereas women in the wider community should be subject to secular laws underpinned by human rights values.
And James, this is a really important question, isn't it? Because domestic abuse, whether it's violence or coercive control, is illegal under British law. So why does a Sharia court need to deal with this? Why can't these women go to the British justice system, and with all its flaws in treating victims of domestic abuse, why can't they?
They can, of course, and they do. I mean, first of all, not all Sharia councils are the same. I mean, I'm not an expert. I haven't been a tour of every council in the country. And I'm sure that there are abuses. There are problems with Sharia and the way that it's implemented, mainly that there's no regulation. So one council may be good and another one may be bad. So that's a caveat. But the one I went to, I have to say, I simply don't recognise, you know, that portrait of it. I was shown a dozen feedback forms from women kind of thanking the council for their good services, and without you, I'd be stuck in the marriage and arrestment. So, and this council did encourage people when it heard appalling cases of domestic violence, and there were a lot. It encouraged them to go to the police. If you've been to the police, you must go and do that. Mm. But that's a different thing from actually getting divorced. And you're right, culture and religion do kind of mix up, but I don't think it's fair to blame the religion for domestic violence.
Nobody's blaming religion for domestic violence, but what we're saying is religion becomes an obstacle for women fleeing domestic violence. We know this because we've worked and campaigned for laws on honour-based violence, laws on forced marriage, laws on FGM and all these other, you know, forms of cultural harm. These laws weren't campaigned for by religious authority. They weren't campaigned for even by the kind of Sharia council that you're describing as a slightly more so-called moderate version. What these laws were campaigned by women who have fought for these laws. So the idea that, you know, these religious councils somehow can grant women these rights is an absolute...
They don't grant the rights, they're granting divorces.
The point is this. 30 years ago, Muslim women did not see the need to get a religious divorce. A civil divorce was recognized. What we're seeing is that Sharia is part of a projection of a political project. It is integrally linked to the projection of very regressive and very fundamentalist norms that are seeping into our communities and getting embedded. And Sharia councils are becoming a opportunistic vehicle for the kind of fundamentalist norms that are being established. And interestingly, those fundamentalist norms that are being established impact most specifically on women through the imposition of dress codes, to the imposition of gender segregation in public spaces, through the imposition of Sharia councils. They're not separate. Sharia laws is part and parcel of the fundamentalist project to impose a particular kind of Muslim identity that actually has no bearing on the lived realities of many Muslim people, including women.
Is this really something that's intrinsic to Islam. I mean, I was speaking recently to a Christian survivor of domestic abuse who was encouraged to return to Absolutely. Her marriage as a result of failings on Yep. both sides by her church.
Absolutely.
So is it not just the case that religion is one of the many things that is harnessed against women who are trying to escape domestic violence?
Absolutely, and all the more reason why you cannot trust religion then to deliver women's rights or to deliver justice. That's the point I'm making. And it's
but
not
can you
intrinsic.
Trust the British legal system either?
Absolutely, it's more open to public scrutiny than so-called religious laws that are, by their very nature, divine laws, unamenable to public scrutiny and to state scrutiny. That's why regulation cannot work. If you look at some of the scholars and some of the judges who've set up and who run these councils, they make it very clear that there are boundaries to these laws that cannot be transgressed. Mm-hmm. And inherently, I would argue that all religions are patriarchal, have patriarchal underpinnings. And that's precisely why they cannot be regulated, because they are the problem, not the solution.
James, what, from your experience and investigations into Sharia courts, what reforms would you think are necessary? There's obviously an ongoing inquiry at the moment into the operation of these courts.
The Mona Siddiqui, indeed. I mean, I would guess that inquiry is going to come back and say there needs to be more regulation. I think there can be regulation. I don't see why there shouldn't be. Actually, there needs to be consistency in the way that Sharia is applied to the things that it does, like divorce, and there isn't enough. So,
is there any sort of kite mark?
Not
or
really.
Oversight
no,
at
there
all?
Isn't, and it's missing. And actually, the Sharia scholars that I spoke to kind of tatted with disapproval at some of the things that were going on in the system. So, for example, there are cases where women trapped in abusive marriages have been kind of nudged back into that abusive. So, this is Sharia councils straying into the area of marriage reconciliation, which they should not be doing. And I agree with you that that is to do with misogyny and cultural weighting towards men. It's wrong. But Sharia properly applied is not any of those things. It's not. I totally disagree with the idea that Sharia is some kind of outrider of the fundamentalist projects. And I just don't think that's true. I mean, what I saw was an essential public service, which if it wasn't doing it, there would be more women trapped in domestic violence.
Absolutely
in
not.
Abusive.
Absolutely
well,
not.
That's what I saw.
You may be, but I've worked in this area for 38 years. I've done nothing
about your expertise,
support
but
abuse
I saw
women.
What I saw.
But you may have seen what you've seen, but you've seen something that's been put up because they know that they are under scrutiny. But they are on a charm offensive. Even the Leytonstone Sharia Council sent us publicity saying, come and view us, because they know they're under scrutiny
Nonsense.
At the moment.
No.
Having said that, regulation cannot work in a climate of austerity when the formal legal system itself is creaking because of lack of resources, when the judiciary cannot manage because of the clogged up legal system. The resources are simply not there to regulate what will be, in effect, a second-rate system of justice.
Well, look, if you wanted to get rid of Sharia, and I hear that you do, you could do it tomorrow by having the state recognise nikah marriages, and then women in those marriages could go to the civil courts and get divorced. But at the moment, they cannot.
I'm really sorry, but the point is that you need to register these marriages, not recognise them. The registration is one issue.
Yes.
But the whole point about these divorces are that the fundamentalists are creating a need and then trying to service that need. 30 years ago, Muslim women did not need a religious divorce to be recognized as having a valid divorce.
We're not where we are.
This is fundamentally a violation of women's human rights.
That was James Ferguson and Pragna Patel. Nigel Dempster, the legendary gossip columnist, died 10 years ago this July. The Daily Mail's John McEntee is celebrating his life in the magazine this week, and he sat down with Sam Leith, our literary editor and former diarist, to discuss Dempster and the dying art of the gossip pages.
So, John, it's been 10 years since Nigel's been gone.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, it just flies. It's frightening. And in fact, his great deadly rival, Ross Benson, he died before him. Amazingly.
Well, he always had this sort of Daily Mail versus Daily Express.
Well, it was our mutual friend, Peter Mackay, who nicknamed the Pompered Poltroon and a Tonsured Traducer, which was a terrible mouthful, for a piece he wrote for the Standard, John Leese's instigation to sort of describe this huge feud, which didn't bother Nigel. You know, Nigel saw off all his rivals, as it were.
He just, well, he inherited a succession. I mean, you became one, didn't you?
Yeah, yeah. And I became one, William Hickey, when Richard Addis revived William Hickey. But the interesting thing is that William Hickey was the original Daily Express column. And when the Express realised that they were being hammered by not just the Mail, but by Dempster in particular, they decided to abolish Hickey and appoint Ross Benson. And of course, they had this wonderful funeral in Fleet Street where Dempster, in his full frock coat and top hat, danced on a coffin, which was William Hickey's coffin, carried by people, Jeff Levy and various other characters from the Express to St Bride's.
But this is a kind of honourable tradition, isn't it? I always think the rivalry between gossip columnists goes back to, you know, that bit in Evelyn Waugh's Vile Bodies, where the guy is, you know, he's missed a scoop. He's putting his head in a gas oven to kill himself. And he puts his head on a piece of newspaper in the gas oven and then notices that it's a copy of his rival's column for that day. And with great dignity, he kind of turns the page of the newspaper over before resuming his suicide. Yeah. You know?
But of course, Nigel would always say, my so-called rivals. And
Dunmarket so-called rivals. Yeah. A sense of how much this is ancient history. I was just, you know, only 10 years, but I was talking just recently to somebody in their 30s and they sort of said, what's a diary? You know, what's a newspaper diary? Because, of course, you're reading online.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't see that. And there's, you know, the cast of characters has changed, and it used to be the minor aristocracy. In the days of Kenneth Rose doing Albany, you know, it was if you were anything lower than Silver Stick and Waiting, you wouldn't be in
Of course.
There. But now it almost feels like there's a sort of diarization of newspapers itself. They've turned inside out. You know, well, I think political story is the front page.
But even in Nigel's declining years, he was furious at what the diary stories were not confined to the diary, because basically newspapers are all diary now. They're all gossip.
Exactly.
So rather than having one page, which was the sanctuary full of gossip about the royal family, about the landed gentry, about the racing fraternity, and occasional TV stars, not all of them. You wouldn't dream of writing about The Only Way is Essex or Made in Chelsea, which didn't exist then. But the difficulty is that nowadays it's all Instagram pictures and Andy Warhol's sort of famous for 15 minutes, basically. And what I find fascinating is that stars will put pictures or allow pictures on Instagram to appear in, say, the Mail's diary, Sebastian Shakespeare, of their children sort of swimming in the Bahamas. And then a week later, will cite privacy issues over their children. And that hasn't been resolved. I mean, there is no legislation in terms of what you can put into a diary or what you're invading somebody's privacy.
To lots of people now, it will seem completely bizarre that all of these diaries, at least when I was just starting out in journalism, which was kind of the tail end of them, they were all named after sort of 18th century figures from, you know, Grub Street. And they all had their own very arch, arcane kind of language. So you'd never talk about, you know, listening to the radio. It had to be the wireless and the gramophone and a long player and a rock band. You know, this in the 1990s, which still describes a popular beat combo.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, but my Bakelite tinkles.
You know. Well, in fact, the Bakelite used to be used as a way to apologise. I mean, Peter MacKay mastered the sort of line, my diamante Bakelite tinkles as I say sorry to the Duke of Buccleuch, basically. But in my time with William Hickey, because William Hickey was an 18th century diarist who coincidentally happened to be Irish, he was a real person, I decided that it was cleverer to adopt this sort of very much an old fogey who had a manservant called Manu, so it was Henry Fitzherbert, and he was the one who went to the parties and knew about what discotheques were about and all that sort of thing. So you could, and Charlotte Edwards, believe it or not, he had a girl called Charlotte who worked for him, and Charlotte worked for me. So I had Charlotte, Manu, and a dog called Caesar.
And Nigel, the oily underbutler.
We invented the oily underbutler, which he didn't mind about. I mean, Nigel was quite funny about the oily underbutler until his dog died. And he devoted 3/4 of a page to Tulip, his chihuahua, who had passed on. And he wrote about, you know, that he was in mourning, meaning Christmas wouldn't be the same again. The dog had died. And I jokingly, just the following day, put in a tiny paragraph saying that the diary was in mourning. William Hickey was in mourning because my pet ferret called Nigel had passed away in the night, and I shall miss his little nose peeping out from his bespoke cage. That, you know, nothing will ever be the same again. And the following day, the phone rang, and Catherine, the secretary, said, Nigel wants to speak to you. And I thought he was just going to say how very droll. And he called me a lot of a lot of bad language. Things you Irish this, podcast, and the gentlest thing, he called me an Irish turd, and said that he was going to write to Lord Hollick and to Rosie Boycott, the editor and proprietor. And also he said, my dog isn't even buried yet. And he was almost weeping. And he then said he was going to report me to the RSPCA for keeping a wild animal indoors, which was the ferret. And I didn't have a ferret. But bizarrely, hundreds of Express readers sympathised on the death of the ferret. We were inundated with messages of condolence.
Well, that will happen. We use very literal words. I had to write my own obituary for Feature once. And for years later, people were coming saying, I thought you died.
Soundly. But and then he cut me. He just wouldn't speak to me for after that. And we were good friends. You know, we used to lunch regularly.
But he was such a good feuder. I mean, I remember when I was working for Peter MacKay years ago, driving in a taxi across Waterloo Bridge and seeing posters slathered all over the place with just a picture of a bald head, and it said Nigel Dempster is bald.
Yeah,
I mean, hundreds of these posters all over South London.
Yeah.
And it turned out it was Jamie Palumbo, who he'd annoyed by writing something unkind about Ministry of Sound. He knew Nigel was sensitive about his hair, and so he plastered the whole of South London with posters about Nigel's.
He was a very good friend, very loyal and very supportive, but if you were an enemy, you know, no holds barred, he would go after you. And he did have vendettas, and he did use the page as a sort of a weapon to attack certain people. And also there are stories that weren't appearing in the column because there were friends of his who might be involved in marital disputes, or they might be involved in all sorts of shenanigans, and they never made the light of day.
That was Sam Leith and John McEntee. And finally, in fields and forests, stooped figures pause beside the slender stems of our native orchids. Over the past year, I have become fascinated by these flowers in all their varieties, from butterfly to burnt to bee, and I'm joined now by Professor Richard Bateman, President of the Hardy Orchid Society, to discuss. So Richard, we're here today as fellow sufferers of an illness called orchid delirium, although I suspect given this is actually your professional occupation, you have a much more extreme version of it. What first attracted you to these strange-looking flowers?
Well, in brief, I inherited a glasshouse from my grandfather at the tender age of 12. Started off with tropical orchids, then suffered an attack of tobacco mosaic virus, killed the lot. And then I discovered we had nice native orchids where I wasn't responsible for their welfare. I didn't have to spend all my pocket money keeping them alive. And everything spiralled out from there.
A lot of people don't realise that we have a lot of native orchids in this country. I mean, I have a lot of orchids on my windowsill at home, but there are also a lot of very beautiful and strange orchids that just grow wild. Just tell us a little bit about those.
Yes, opinions differ. And this particular storm is one I'm at the eye of, but there are roughly 52 species of orchid in Britain. A lot of them are rare, a lot of them are of conservation concern. And most people simply don't realise that within a mile or two of their front doorstep, even in central London, there is a native orchid.
And I've spent, as I say in the piece in this week's magazine, the past few months travelling around nature reserves in Cumbria and Lancashire to find strange orchids like the fly orchid, the bee orchid, the butterfly orchid. How many strange orchids are there? I mean, the fly orchid in particular is a very strange-looking flower.
Well, the first thing I'd say is, based on what you've just said and based on your article, you refer to orchid delirium. Well, I'm afraid you've actually become an orchid idiot. Once you're this entranced by these orchids, there's no turning back. The fly orchid is a lovely example. It's actually my favourite British orchid.
Why is that?
It's because it has evolved an extraordinary pollination mechanism where it actually exudes pheromones of a particular species of insect, which is sufficient to attract the insect to the flower. It then has a reflective surface that looks just like the wings of the female of this particular insect. The male lands on the flower, attempts to mate with it, and in so doing picks up the pollen masses from the orchid. And if you're really lucky and it's stupid enough to attempt the same thing again, it transfers the pollen mass to the next orchid.
There's another orchid that I really want to see, which is the lizard orchid, which my orchid book tells me smells distinctively of billy goats. Is that true? Why not female goats? This all sounds very strange.
I think there might be an element of misogynism here. So I can't tell the difference myself. Possibly a goat can. Yes, it's certainly true that they do smell that way. Funnily enough, I've just come back from northern Greece, where I've been looking at the Eastern Mediterranean equivalent of the British plant. and they are rumoured to smell significantly different and much sweeter. My nose, I'm afraid, wasn't sensitive enough to distinguish them.
And do they attract lizards?
They do not, no. They attract various kinds of bee. Fairly successfully these days. I don't know if you've been to the golf course at Sandwich, which is the famous place for British lizard orchids, and they... When I first knew it 30-odd years ago, they were a relatively small population. They're now a real hazard for the golfers.
What is it about orchids in particular? We've obviously just talked about some very weird and wonderful lizard and fly-shaped flowers. Is it that? Is it just that they seem exotic because we expect to find them growing in a greenhouse and then suddenly we find them on a hill in the Chilterns?
Well, I think orchids have somehow achieved the best of both possible worlds, because we do tend to think that they have a mystique, we think they're exotic, but at the same time they're in every supermarket and every DIY store now. So you're quite right, people are familiar with the tropical ones. Many are unfamiliar with the idea that there are many British equivalents, maybe not quite as spectacular, although, as you know, there are one or two that are, but much more interesting to look at, much easier to find, and you do not have to have them littering up your bathroom.
And you've discovered new species of orchids in Europe, I believe. New butterfly orchids, is that correct?
I think the orchids you're referring to are actually on the Azores. This is one of the nice things about orchids. The British orchids only invaded this country about 10,000 years ago after the ice sheet receded. So what we're having is kind of the ends of various migrations that have come over in the last 10,000 years. To understand where those migrants started, we have to start looking at the European flora, the Atlantic flora. It gives me an excuse to just travel around, look at the orchids, study them, analyse their DNA, whatever's going to tell us the most information about them.
And I wonder whether, as a professional botanist, as opposed to a very amateurish person who's always leafing through their guidebook looking a bit nonplussed like me, whether you have the same sensation when you're hunting for plants. For me, it's such a wonderful feeling, just focusing on the ground in front of me. Actually takes me far away from my own mind, from my own troubles, because you have to look so hard for some of these small plants. And the satisfaction of combing a field for 2 hours and then finally finding a coral root orchid, for instance, is just tremendous in a way that's very difficult to explain to friends who just think I'm actually mad. Do you have that feeling too, or does it feel like a job?
Oh, no. I've managed to alternate effectively between being amateur and professional, amateur and professional.
So orchids have taken over your life, is that what you're saying?
They have. I think that's a fair description. I've just come back from 2 days surveying the Chiltern Hills, starting in Dunstable, ending in Goring, looking for the frog orchid, which is about the most insignificant small green flower plant you could possibly imagine. A slightly scary experience, actually, because most of the sites that were supposed to have populations no longer have them. I think this climate change is biting on that particular orchid. But just even then, the pleasure of actually finding some of those populations still alive, there was a degree of exultance yesterday, yes.
Is there an orchid you haven't seen that you'd really like to find? I'm wondering whether you've ever seen a ghost orchid, for instance.
Well, I have seen the ghost orchid. I was the one who eventually declared it extinct in Britain after 2 decades of lack of observations, and I did so hoping that someone would then come along and say, oh no, I've seen one. And that happened, but it was one plant in 1 year with one flower.
And that was it?
To the best of my knowledge, it's not been seen again. Of course, some people are keen to keep this information secret, even from supposed experts like myself. But
well, this is the really interesting thing about orchids. It's not just that it sends people mad, people want to steal orchids, don't they? But what do they do with them?
Some. I suspect they watch them die very quickly for the most part. It's a crazy idea anyway, because we're very good at growing these things from seed now. And if you're going to steal something, at least just steal a capsule, don't steal the entire plant. But this is a major issue we're talking about now, whether you imprison the orchids or whether you provide open access for them. For some of my colleagues, I lean too far towards the open access end of the spectrum. I think the orchids are there to be enjoyed. Yes, there's some threat presented if word gets around too widely about a particularly rare orchid, but personally, I feel it's worth the risk.
And so for anyone who's hoping to catch this madness, can you recommend some places to go orchid hunting, maybe in the next few weeks, and what the best orchids to look out for are?
Well, the season is two-thirds over now, so perhaps the timing isn't ideal. I would certainly recommend to anybody that they join either the Botanical Society of Britain and Ireland or the Hardy Orchid Society, or both. I recommend they go to their local naturalist trusts, who always have reserves that have good populations of orchids on them. But in terms of actual places to go, Box Hill is still pretty good in Surrey. The Warburg Reserve in Oxfordshire attracts quite a lot of people. Beautiful place. I'd start off with large reserves with a lot of different flora where you're not going to do a lot of damage by trampling, where there's likely to be a warden of some kind who'll show you the interesting plants if you ask them, and then spiral outwards from there.
And finally, what sort of people catch orchid delirium? I have to confess that on the guided walks I've done looking for orchids, I've been the only woman. I've been about 20 years younger than everyone else there, and I think I'm probably one of the only people who goes orchid hunting wearing lipstick from MAC. So is there a certain type of person who's particularly susceptible?
Do you know, I don't think there is in the orchid world. If you think about the more broad field botany, then that is really under threat, and the majority of people involved in general botany are now increasingly aged. I found the orchid community to be a more egalitarian one, frankly. The description you just gave certainly doesn't match the Hardy Orchid Society, where we've got 550 members of every age and every persuasion. And the membership is actually growing at a time when most societies are losing membership. So, no, I think you'll be able to find a broader community if you stick with it.
That was Richard Bateman. That's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. You can also subscribe to our other shows, including Americano, our podcast that looks at what's happening in Trump's America, hosted by Freddie Gray. And if you enjoy the podcasts, why not pick up the magazine? You can read all the features discussed on this podcast, as well as great pieces by Kelvin McKenzie, James Dellingpole and Simon Barnes. And we have a special offer for podcast listeners, 12 issues for £12 and a limited edition Spectator Moleskine notebook if you subscribe at spectator.co.uk/podoffer. Thanks for listening.